From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Thanksgiving edition of Fresh Air, we hear about the life and music of a great American songwriter, Johnny Mercer. He wrote the lyrics to such songs as Jeepers Creepers, The Days of Wine and Roses, Come Rain or Come Shine, That Old Black Magic, Moon River, and One for My Baby. We'll hear from Philip Furia, the author of a biography of Mercer, which includes the story of his secret affair with Judy Garland. Also, music critic Lord Schwartz plays great movie themes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iran said today that it wants to exempt some equipment from an agreement to suspend its nuclear enrichment program. Iranian leaders made the agreement with the European Union, saying that they would suspend all such activities. NPR's Mike Schuster says the new condition is running into opposition from the U.S. and other nations.
The Iranians want to be allowed to operate these few gas centrifuges as an exception. And there are some other nations that say, okay, as long as they suspend all their other uranium enrichment activities. But the Europeans and certainly the United States are arguing that no, the Iranians should be held to the absolute letter of the agreement, suspend all of their uranium enrichment activities to see whether they are capable over the midterm of actually implementing an agreement.
NPR's Mike Schuster. Iran has insisted that it only wants to enrich uranium for use in nuclear power plants, but the U.S. maintains the program is really designed to produce nuclear weapons. The U.N. Atomic Energy Agency is expected to take up the issue tomorrow. Ukraine's Supreme Court has ruled that the results of Sunday's presidential election will not be official until it hears an appeal from an opposition candidate who says the election was stolen. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports that demonstrations against the election results are growing.
There's an enormous hill where I'm sitting near Independence Square, where I'm standing in Independence Square, and up the hill there are people just lining the hillsides, up on the streets, up on a terrace overlooking the square. There are people all over the place, many of them waving flags. There are people who've come in even from Poland. I just spoke with a group of young people from Poland, from Krakow, who got together 50 of their friends and came in buses, they said, to support what they called Ukrainian democracy.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets in Kiev. Thousands of people in Texas are still living outside their homes because of flooding from rains and damage from tornadoes earlier in the week. NPR's John Burnett reports.
This has been a very violent week for weather in a large portion of the Deep South. It started in Texas when lines of thunderstorms came for 4 days straight, drenching parts of central Texas. The Guadalupe and the Colorado River came out of their banks, forcing thousands to abandon their homes in central Texas. That same line of thunderstorms moved into East Texas, where authorities estimate about more than a dozen twisters touch ground in Hardin County, close to the Louisiana border.
NPR's John Burnett reporting that the weather in Texas is going to get worse before it improves. The Colorado River is expected to crest tomorrow morning, and authorities in Wharton County have asked 2,500 people there to evacuate. Meanwhile, President Bush celebrated Thanksgiving at his ranch today near Crawford, Texas. This is NPR News. Some Marine units in Iraq got their first hot meal in weeks today. They were trucked back from the front line in Fallujah for Thanksgiving dinner. Food workers also delivered dinners to the troops who are still on patrol in the shattered Iraqi city. Many troops also celebrated the day with calls home to their families. Their celebration was part of a worldwide recognition for U.S. service members stationed around the world. To mark the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, the United Nations is calling for the protection of women's rights as the way to curb gender violence. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The United Nations says violence against women is the most pervasive of all violations of human rights. Too often, such violence is tolerated and the perpetrators go unpunished. A UN protection official, Joyce Menz-Cole, says women are victimized in their homes, their communities, and in the name of culture and tradition.
We have violence caused or condoned by the state, rape by government officials, torture in custody, violence by border guards against asylum seekers.
The United Nations says violence against women is particularly widespread in situations of armed conflict where they become victims of rape and other forms of sexual abuse. It calls upon governments to provide more legal protections for women. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Best-selling writer Arthur Haley has died from an apparent stroke at his home in the Bahamas. He was 84. Haley came to fame in 1968 with his novel Airport. In all, Haley published 11 books, which were translated into 38 languages. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you're having a good holiday. On this Thanksgiving edition, we're going to hear about the life and music of a great American songwriter, Johnny Mercer. He wrote the lyrics to many now classic songs. Here's just a few of them.
You must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a wonderful child. When you were only starting to go to kindergarten, I bet you drove the little boys wild. And when it came...
You're just too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, and that old standby amorous. It's all so wonderful, I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough, I mean they just aren't swelling up. You're much too much.
I don't care what the weatherman says. When the weatherman says it's raining, you'll never hear me complaining. I'm certain sunshine. I don't care how the weather vane points. When the weather vane points to gloomy, it's got to be sunny to me. When your eyes look into mine. Oh, jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Oh gosh, I'll get out.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails. My mama done told me a man's gonna sweet talk and give you the big eye, but when the sweet talking's done, a man is a two-faced, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night.
I took a trip on a train and I thought about you. I passed a shadowy lane and I thought about you. Two or three cars parked under the stars.
I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true. A few kisses ago.
I wanna be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. A somebody who will swear to be true as you used to do with me.
Among the many Johnny Mercer lyrics that we couldn't squeeze into that medley are Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home, Come Rain or Come Shine, Days of Wine and Roses, Fools Rush In, Hooray for Hollywood, Moon River, One for My Baby, Something's Gotta Give, and That Old Black Magic. Mercer's period of greatest popularity was between the mid-1930s and mid-50s. There were 221 weeks within that period when Mercer had at least one song in the top 10. My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of a biography of Mercer called Skylark. It will be published in paperback December 9th. Furia is also the author of The Poets of Tin Pan Alley and books about Irving Berlin and Ira Gershwin. As part of his research for Skylark, Furia interviewed many of Mercer's surviving family, friends, and colleagues. Mercer was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1909 and died in 1976. The title of the Mercer biography comes from a song he co-authored with Hoagie Carmichael. Here's Carmichael's 1956 recording of Skylark.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring where my heart can go a-journeying over the shadows and the rain to a blossom-covered lane?
Philip Furia told me that Johnny Mercer came from a different background than his contemporaries in the pantheon of American popular song.
Mercer was the only Southerner in that whole group of largely New York Jewish immigrants or descended from immigrants, songwriters. The Gershwins, Berlin, even Cole Porter, who came from Indiana, can sound more New Yorkish, more urbane than anyone else. And here's Johnny Mercer from Savannah, an Episcopalian choir boy, mingling with all of these sophisticated, hard-nosed New York Jewish songwriters. And I thought, what a world for him to move in.
Let's get to Johnny Mercer's first lyric that actually had a life outside of his house. and that lyric is Out of Breath. And this is a song that he actually got into the Garrick Gaieties, which was a review, a musical review. How did he write the song?
Well, Johnny Mercer was a lyricist who, like most lyricists, wrote lyrics after music was completed. And he had a collaborator who had given him a melody, and he worked and worked and worked on it. And actually, his ambition was to be an actor. He really went to New York from Savannah wanting to make it as an actor, and it was a bug that never let go of him. And he went to the Garrick Gaieties and tried to get a role. And they said, nope, we don't need any more actors. All we need are pretty girls and songs. So he went back to this melody that his collaborator had given him, and worked and worked and wrote many, many verses to it and took it over to the show, and they loved it. And it actually was featured very prominently in Garrick Gaieties.
Had he not thought about writing lyrics before this?
No, he had been doing that ever since he was about 15. He had been writing lyrics in his usual style because he loved what were then called race records, blues that were largely marketed to black audiences. And he loved Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and Louis Armstrong. And he wrote a lot of very, very vernacular, bluesy kinds of lyrics. But this was his first, Out of Breath was his first review for first song for a Broadway review. And it has a kind of New York sophistication to it. He could be that urbane New Yorker when he wanted to be.
Well, let's hear Johnny Mercer singing Out of Breath. And this was recorded in 1971 when he appeared at the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Here's Johnny Mercer.
Mine's a hopeless case, but there's one saving grace. Anyone would feel as I do. Out of breath and scared to death of you. Love was first divined, then explored and defined. Still the old sensation is new. Out of breath and scared to death of you. It takes all the strength that I can call to my command
to hold your hand. I would speak at length about the love that should be made, but I'm afraid. Hercules and such never bothered me much. All you have to do is say boo. I'm out of breath and scared to death of you.
That's Johnny Mercer singing the first song, the first lyric that he wrote that actually got performed in a show. And that was recorded in 1971. My guest is Philip Furia, who has written a new biography of Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. Well, Johnny Mercer's song Out of Breath was performed in 1930 in Garrett Gaiety's. What were the typical ways of breaking into music for a young songwriter at that time?
Well, for a young songwriter in New York, the way you broke in was through Tin Pan Alley, which was where all the sheet music publishers had their offices and where so many songs were kind of mass-produced, almost assembly line produced. And Johnny Mercer walked the pavements. He went to various music publishers trying to get them to accept his songs. But it really took a long time before, even though he could place a song here and there in a Broadway review, it took him 3 or 4 years before he really had a hit song.
What was that first hit?
First hit was a song he wrote with Hoagy Carmichael in 1933 called Lazy Bones. And they sold the song to a publisher, and they got a recording of it. And both of them at that time were so poor that the banks wouldn't cash their royalty, their first royalty checks was for like $1,000 because these guys looked so seedy. So one of the singers who had recorded the song took it to her bank and got it cashed. But it was their first big break. It was Mercer's first big break. Carmichael had a couple of successful songs before that.
And after working with Hoagy Carmichael, Mercer went on to be the songwriter for the Paul Whiteman Band. Hoagy Carmichael and Paul Whiteman had already worked together. Was it typical for big bands then to have a songwriter on staff?
No, it was not typical. But Mercer was also a wonderful singer. And he actually broke into Paul Whiteman's band by winning a national singing contest. He was the New York champion, and then he won the national contest. And Whiteman kept him on as a singer, actually to replace Bing Crosby. Crosby went to Hollywood, and Whiteman needed someone who could sing very rhythmical, jazzy tunes, and that was Mercer's talent. He had grown up listening to black records and, you know, black church music as a kid, so he had a wonderful sense of rhythm and jazz. And he sang with Whiteman for several years.
My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of Skylark, The Life and Times of Johnny Mercer. It's about to be published in paperback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Furia, the author of a biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer. It's called Skylark. Johnny Mercer wrote for Hollywood in two different parts of his life. How did he get started writing for Hollywood? And Hollywood was another great way for a songwriter to become known and for his songs to become known.
Hollywood got interested in him when they heard him on the radio singing with Paul Whiteman. And Mercer's singing voice on the radio came across as if he were black. In fact, Whiteman had teamed him with his trombonist, a great jazz trombonist, Jack Teagarden, and they were a kind of Amos and Andy act. And everyone who listened thought these were two blacks who were, you know, talking dialogue back and forth and then breaking into song. And RKO Studios had a producer who really loved that sound and invited Mercer out to Hollywood to be an actor, a singer, and a songwriter. It was kind of like a triple threat. And Mercer still had that acting bug in him. He wanted to make it. He wanted to be a movie star like Bing Crosby. He was just astonished at the success Crosby had when he went out to Hollywood. And Mercer thought, this is going to happen to me. And so he left a great job with Paul Whiteman's band, went out to Hollywood, actually made two movies, and as an actor was a disaster. And wrote a few songs while he was out there, wrote a song with Fred Astaire called I'm Building Up to an Awful Letdown. But basically, his first venture into Hollywood was a bust. And they didn't renew his contract at RKO, and he was left high and dry.
And then a song that he wrote after leaving Hollywood ended up becoming his ticket back into Hollywood. And that song was I'm an Old Cowhand. Tell the story of the song and how it changed his life.
Well, after RKO canceled his contract, he realized how tough it was to make it in Hollywood. And as he did so often in his life, he wanted to get back home to Savannah, get back to his roots. And so he and his wife, and this is in, 1936, got in a car and drove from Hollywood to Savannah. They'd never done that before, and they never did it again. It took him 3 days to drive across Texas. And as he was driving across Texas, he was astounded at seeing these cowboys in big hats and with spurs on, and they were driving cars and trucks. And I think, after his bad experience in Hollywood, he kind of saw how ridiculous the image Hollywood portrayed of the Western cowboy was. And here was, in fact, in Texas, life imitating art. So the song came to him as they were driving. I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande, and I ride the range in my Ford V8. So it was a kind of, send-up of the Hollywood that he'd come to really despise. And also, just a very amusing look at the way these Texas cowboys were trying to look like the ones in the movies.
Mercer went to Hollywood hoping to have the kind of success he saw Bing Crosby have. And Bing Crosby was the one who actually recorded I'm an Old Cowhand, turned it into a hit and a well-known song. How did Bing Crosby end up recording it?
Well, Crosby and Mercer were friends, actually, through their wives. Johnny's wife, Ginger, had been a chorus girl, and she had made friends with another chorus girl, Dixie Lee, who went on to marry Bing Crosby, and also Dolores Hope, who married Bob Hope. So the three women were lifelong friends. And as often happens, when the women are friends, the wives are friends, the husbands become friends, too. So that Crosby kind of looked out for Johnny Mercer and helped him along, particularly during those kind of bleak early years in Hollywood in the 1930s. He recorded songs with him, or he would sing songs either on recordings or in movies that Johnny Mercer had written. So in some ways, he was kind of a mentor for Johnny Mercer.
So Bing Crosby sang the song in the movie Rhythm on the Range, and here's Bing Crosby's 1936 recording of I'm an Old Cowhand with a lyric by Johnny Mercer.
I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande, but my legs ain't bold and my cheeks ain't tan. I'm a cowboy who never saw a cow, never roped a steer, cause I don't know how. Sure ain't a fixin' to start him now. Oh, yippee-i-yo-ki. Yippee-i-yo-ki. I'm an old cowhand and I come down from the Rio Grande. And I learned to ride, 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 for I learned to stand. I'm a riding fool who is up to date. I know every trail in the Lone Star State, cause I ride the range in the Ford V8. Oh, yippee-i-yo-ki.
That's I'm an Old Cowhand, recorded in 1936 by Bing Crosby. My guest, Philip Furia, is the author of a biography of Johnny Mercer, who wrote that song. This is one of the few songs where Johnny Mercer wrote music and lyrics?
He wrote several where he actually did music, too, even though he could not read music and couldn't play a musical instrument. But it was very much like Irving Berlin. He would hear not only a melody, but harmonies in his head. And then he would go to a piano player and sing the song. And then the piano player would pick it out. And then Mercer would work with him playing the chords. It was really extraordinary. I interviewed his former son-in-law, who was a pianist, who had written some songs with him like that. And he said it took forever, but he knew exactly the chords he wanted. He could hear them in his head.
Now, when he was in Hollywood, Johnny Mercer fell in love with Judy Garland. They had an affair. How long did that affair last?
It started in 1941, and it was an on-and-off-again affair that lasted really until Judy Garland died. It was the most extraordinary thing I learned about him in researching the book, that Judy Garland really was the great, great love of his life. And she was about to get married to her first husband. And she really wanted an older man. And she was very interested in men with literary and artistic qualities to them. And I think she fell deeply in love with Johnny Mercer. But he was married and had just adopted a little girl. And he had this Southern genteel principle that he did not believe in divorce. And Judy Garland had just finally gotten some success in The Wizard of Oz and realized, I think, that if word had gotten out that she was having an affair with an older married man, that her career, after waiting so long to take off, would have been in jeopardy. And she actually broke it off. And Mercer never got over it, and they renewed it several times until her death. And at another point in the 1960s, he actually asked Ginger for a divorce so that he could finally marry Judy Garland. And his kids were grown by then, and he was ready to walk out of the marriage. But again, it didn't take off. His wife became deathly ill. Doctors told him that she was going to die very soon. And he went in to see her in the hospital, and she said, "Please don't divorce me now." And he said, I'll stay with you as long as you live." And she recovered and lived for another 30 years.
Philip Furia's biography of Johnny Mercer is called Skylark. It's about to be published in paperback. We'll talk more about Mercer and hear more of his songs in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Judy Garland singing a lyric written for her by Johnny Mercer.
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. The same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator starts its ride. And down I go.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair, by Starbucks Coffee Company. On behalf of all neighborhood locations, Starbucks is proud to support NPR during the holiday season. And from Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of His Excellency George Washington by Joseph J. Ellis, author of Founding Brothers. This is NPR, National Public Radio. That's the theme from the film Laura. Johnny Mercer wrote the lyric. Coming up, more on Mercer's movie songs, including Moon River. We continue our conversation with his biographer, Philip Furia. And music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays great movie themes.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Furia, the author of a biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer called Skylark. It's about to come out in paperback. Mercer's songs include Skylark, Moon River, The Days of Wine and Roses, Come Rain or Come Shine, Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home, I Thought About You, and Hooray for Hollywood. When we left off, Furia was talking about Johnny Mercer's secret affair with Judy Garland. Furia told me that even most Hollywood insiders didn't know about the affair.
It was not well known. In fact, in one Garland biography, there was an interview with Mickey Rooney, who said in 1941, Judy Garland had finally found the man she loved, and Rooney didn't know who it was. So it was kept pretty secret. It was just a few people in the family who knew about it, but they said Johnny was just gaga over her. You couldn't even talk to him. He'd just be staring straight forward, and you know, you'd have to kind of snap your fingers in front of his face. But the fact that it happened in 1941 and was so heartrending for him, it was one of those great lucky breaks that he was at that time starting to collaborate with Harold Arlen. And suddenly, in Mercer's lyrics, you know, before that he'd written Jeepers Creepers and I'm an Old Cow Hand and You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby, but suddenly there comes this wrenching, agonizing pain into his lyrics, and he writes Blues in the Night, One for My Baby. You know, there's a whole new depth of emotion, and I'm sure it comes out of the affair with Garland. Also, a new kind of sensuality in things like That Old Black Magic, which is a song he wrote for her. So, you know, in a way, Judy Garland, although the love affair didn't work out, she kind of became his muse. And in a way, Judy Garland did that to Johnny Mercer.
Why don't we hear one of the songs that Mercer wrote with Arlen in this period? Why don't we listen to One for My Baby? And although this is such a deeply felt song and such a kind of heartbreaking song, it was written for the movie The Sky's the Limit and originally sung by Fred Astaire, who gives it a much jauntier rendition than what we're used to hearing from Sinatra.
Yeah, Sinatra's rendition, I think, is the classic one, and he captures all the pain. He once said a Johnny Mercer lyric is all the wit you wish you had and all the love you ever lost. And boy, he hit it with One for My Baby.
Oh, here's Frank Sinatra.
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. I got the routine. Put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad. Can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you gotta be true to your code. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
That's Frank Sinatra singing One for My Baby, music by Harold Arlen, a lyric by Johnny Mercer. And Johnny Mercer is the subject of a new biography called Skylark, written by my guest, Philip Furia. So Johnny Mercer finally did have his success in Hollywood. But then what he really wanted was a hit Broadway show.
Oh, it just killed him that other Hollywood songwriters that he was senior to, like Frank Lesser, and Alan J. Lerner. They went out to Broadway, and they had these smash hits like Guys and Dolls and My Fair Lady. And Mercer could see that those shows would be immortal. They would be revived over and over again. He always wanted that, and he never got it. He had successful shows like Little Abner, but no one's ever revived it. And it was just as one friend said, one of the big holes in his heart was his inability to write a great Broadway musical.
Now, with Harold Arlen, he did write the songs for the show St. Louis Woman.
Right.
And that had a song that became a really big hit for him, Come Rain or Come Shine. It had I Had Myself a True Love, which is another well-known song. And Riding on the Moon, a great song that isn't as well-known, but you know, some people still do it. How successful was the show?
The show was a flop. It was supposed to have starred Lena Horne. And that's why Mercer agreed to do it, because he had doubts about the book, the script for the show. It was written by two black writers, Arna Bontemps and County Cullen. And it's just a real clunker of a story. And Lena Horne was approached by the NAACP, and they pressured her not to do it, because even though the show was written by blacks, it had some pretty awful racial stereotypes and a lot of kind of phony black dialect. And Lena Horne pulled out of the show. And for Mercer, that was the end, even though they had a wonderful new actress named Pearl Bailey, who had the secondary role. But without a big-name star like Lena Horne and with that clunker of a book, that great, great score, the Arlen Mercer score, was pretty much lost except for the big hit, Come Rain or Come Shine, which they recorded when the show opened. I think Margaret Whiting did a recording of that. And that was the only thing he could salvage.
Well, why don't we play a version of Come Rain or Come Shine? Why don't we hear the Ray Charles version of it?
Okay.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you. Come rain or come shine. High as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just a one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true. Well, if you let me, you're gonna love me like no one's loved me. Come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together, and wouldn't it be fine? Days may be cloudy or sunny, we're in or we're out of the money, yeah, but I'm with you always. Your rain or shine.
That's Ray Charles singing Come Rain or Come Shine, which was written by Harold Arlen and lyricist Johnny Mercer for the show St. Louis Woman. And my guest Philip Furia is the author of a biography of Johnny Mercer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Furia, the author of a biography of lyricist Johnny Mercer called Skylark. It's about to be published in paperback. Here's Johnny Mercer as recorded in 1971 at the 92nd Street Y in New York as part of its Lyrics and Lyricists series. He's being interviewed by the director of the series, Maurice Levine.
That leads to that classic question which everyone asks, what comes first, the melody or the lyric? And I gather from what you've said that you like to have a good melody before you.
With me, I prefer that.
Right.
I much prefer that.
Your Parbrick said the same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know why? He feels music like a composer, and so do I. So we understand the music. We know where the accents should come. And I don't mean to sound conceited when I say this, but I've often had a lot of good lyrics loused up by writing them first, because the guy doesn't understand what I'm, the meter that I want. I'd rather try and catch the mood of his tune than have him. Now, there are some exceptions. Mr. Rogers is magnificent, you know, at writing two words. But I think most guys rather do it the other way.
How did Johnny Mercer react to the musical changes of the 1950s when rock and roll was the music for young people, and it was crowding out American popular song from the charts? It was competing with it.
Well, Johnny Mercer, like so many of the other great, great songwriters of his era, really resented the coming of rock and roll, where, you know, performers were writing their own songs, and you know, there was just a complete fall off in the quality of songs. Songs were being aimed at the teenage market. And, you know, Ira Gershwin, Irving Berlin, those people could complain about it, but they'd had their careers. The sad thing about Mercer is that he was in his 40s, at the top of his form, and American popular music was moving away from him, and it was agonizing for him. And Hollywood musicals were starting to collapse because of the influx of television. They were shutting down movie production, and musicals were the most expensive kind of movies to make. There was less and less work for him writing scores for movies. So it was really a bitter, bitter time for him, the 1950s.
So here he was. Here was Mercer feeling very embattled because of the growing popularity of rock and roll, and movies again saved him.
Yeah, they weren't making many original movie musicals anymore. They were pretty much just doing movie versions of shows that had been hits on Broadway. But they still had what were called theme songs. A dramatic movie, not a musical, might have a song attached to it. And that's what finally saved Mercer in the 1960s. He teamed with Henry Mancini. And there was a movie, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Johnny Mercer had to go ask Mancini. I mean, this was as far down as he was on his luck. He asked this young composer if he could please work with him and try to write a song to Mancini's melody for Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Mancini was thrilled to collaborate with Johnny Mercer. And Mercer, as often he did with collaborators, he would get the music in his head, and then he wanted to be by himself. He didn't like to be in the same room with a collaborator. And he would come back with sometimes two or three lyrics, different lyrics, and say to the composer, which one do you like? And the one he actually wrote for Breakfast at Tiffany's, the first one he wrote was called I'm Holly. You know, I'm Holly, like I want to be, like Holly on a tree back home. And Mancini said, well, okay, that fits the main character of the movie, Holly Golightly, but what else do you have? And he said, well, I've got this one that could either be called Red River, Blue River, or Moon River. And Mancini listened to it and just heard those first three notes, Moon River, and just knew at the time he was going to win the Academy Award. That wonderful opening. And suddenly Mercer was back. He won the Academy Award. Andy Williams made a hit record of it. And then the next year, he and Mancini won it again with Days of Wine and Roses. And it was a thrill. I mean, just one song a year. But he was on talk shows and people knew his name again. So it was a kind of wonderful comeback for him in the 1960s.
What was it like to research this book and to talk to people who are alive now and knew or worked with Johnny Mercer?
It was surprisingly difficult for me because I had known a little bit about how he behaved when he drank. But so many people, and these people who absolutely adored him, told me these horrible, horrible stories about him, that at cocktail parties he would curse at his wife. and sometimes would take his drink and pour it over her head at a party, that he would make sexual overtures to daughters of his collaborators, even to one of his own nieces, who told me this. And she was just revolted. And she thought I'd always been like a daughter to him. I was the same age as his daughter. And he got drunk and made it past me. And I found that very difficult to write about. And the sad thing is that he would attack everybody around him. And then, unlike some drunks who forget the next morning, he would always remember. And that Southern proper upbringing would come back. And he would feel terrible remorse and would inevitably send a dozen roses to whomever he'd offended the next morning with his abject note of apology. So, yeah, it was in some ways a horrible life that he would be so abominable when he drank and then feel so guilty the next morning. And it was just like, there was a while there I couldn't write about him. I found him so repulsive, a person when he drank.
So you're in that position that we are with a lot of artists, unfortunately, which is learning how to keep loving the art while feeling uncomfortable about the artist.
Yeah, I'd never been in that position before. But finally, after interviewing more people, and the interviews would get very, very emotional sometimes as people talked about how much they loved him, but then would recount these grisly stories about him. And finally, I began to see how tormented he was. Mm-hmm. And it was a torment that went all the way back to his childhood and the kinds of tremendous expectations that his family made on him to make everything right, to always be the kindest, most generous person, to fix everything that went wrong in the family. And I just felt that this enormous pressure that when he drank, he could be bad. He could get out from under that. And I began to feel a kind of sympathy for him that just built and built, and then I could write.
Well, Philip Furia, thank you so much for talking with us about Johnny Mercer.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Philip Furia's biography of Johnny Mercer is called Skylark. It will be published in paperback in a couple of weeks. Our interview was recorded last December after the book was published in hardcover. Furia is a professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Here's Ella Fitzgerald singing another Johnny Mercer song.
You've got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between. You've got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark, what did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
Coming up, music critic Lord Schwartz considers great movie themes. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Some of the most memorable music written for the movies comes even before the movie begins. The opening theme music, sometimes starting before the credits roll, serves very different functions for different films. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about some of his favorite themes from films now available on DVD.
That may be the most famous movie music ever written, Max Steiner's sweeping, heroic theme for Gone with the Wind. Even if you didn't know the story, is there anyone who doesn't know the story? You'd know that we were being set up for a movie of high drama, passion and courage, and great length. The theme itself may be too simple for a composer to develop into a symphony, but its succinctness is one of the qualities that makes it impossible to forget. What most of us don't remember is that there's music that comes even before the famous theme, a 2.5-minute overture that suggests the happy, peaceful life on the old plantation before the Civil War. Gone with the Wind has just reappeared in a new 4-disc DVD set with a gloriously restored print and lots of special features, including the fascinating documentary that shows us the screen tests for the many actresses who wanted the role of the decade, Scarlett O'Hara. Max Steiner's score for Gone with the Wind, which keeps us at a distance, is very different from the opening music of a movie that isn't nearly as well known, but I think it's one of the real masterpieces of world cinema, Federico Fellini's early I Vitelloni. It's an intimate story of five friends who are trapped in the small Italian seaside town where they grew up, trapped in their lives, suddenly becoming too old to act like kids, but not yet ready for real responsibility. Even before the credits roll, we see this would-be rat pack lurching arm in arm down a deserted street after a night of drinking. The music, which pulls us immediately into the film, is by Fellini's great musical collaborator, Nino Rota, and it captures Fellini's affection and ironic nostalgia, one of the young bucks is surely himself, for these guys and their heartbreaking hopelessness. Jean Renoir's The Golden Coach uses music that was composed centuries before movies were invented, and he uses it to suggest not so much sincerity as artificiality. Filmed in ravishing, supersaturated color and starring that great life force, Anna Magnani, The Golden Coach is about a troupe of 18th century Commedia dell'arte players who travel to South America. And it's one of Renoir's most intricate explorations of how the boundary between art and real life often blurs, and the sacrifices artists are compelled to make for their art. Renoir chose the perfect composer, Vivaldi, who instantly takes us back to an earlier time, a time of bustling energy, festivity, and glittering artifice. Elegance with just a touch of the street. I'd like to end with a little closing music from a film that I forgot had any music at all, the great horror film director Todd Browning's bizarre, scary, and poignant Freaks, a 1932 classic about the underside of life at a carnival sideshow. Seeing the film again after many years, I was especially hit by the irony of the score. The way the few seconds of lighthearted circus music at the very end, for example, make a chilling commentary on all the horrors that have gone before. In all these films, music adds another dimension, another emotional layer. We think of film as a visual medium, but it's impossible to imagine these extraordinary movies without the music that goes with them.
Lord Schwartz teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross. We all wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sickened, The True Story of a Lost Childhood, a memoir by Munchausen by Proxy survivor Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The hilarious sketch comedy series SCTV is now on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with some of SCTV's stars, Martin Short, Dave Thomas, Eugene Levy, and Catherine O'Hara. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.